This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. As we head into the Labor Day weekend, we'll take a look this hour at workers who are often invisible underneath the colorful uniforms at McDonald's or Walmart, people who clean our floors at night, care for our children during the day, or pick the food we eat. When we do hear about low-wage workers, it's often in the context of the debates over minimum wage or health care, mass transit, or low-cost housing. We've discussed those issues before. We will again. We will touch on them today. But we want to focus on who these people are, what they do, and how they view their lives and their futures. If you've held a low-wage job, if you're in one now, call and tell us what it's like. Is it a dead end, or is it the first step up? If you're an employer who uses minimum wage workers, we'd also like to hear from you. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And here to help us is NPR's Noah Adams, best known as the longtime host of All Things Considered. Noah's with us here in Studio 3A, and a welcome to Talk of the Nation.
It's a pleasure to be here, Neil.
Now, over the past several months, you've produced a series of stories about low-wage workers. How did this assignment come about?
It's sort of a dream. My boss at All Things Considered, Ellen Weiss, back a couple of years ago, said, why don't we do a series about working? And she was a big fan of the Studs Terkel book that goes back to the 70s. And I thought about that for a time, and then I thought, well, why not do low-wage workers in this country? Find something with a little bit of tension and grit to it and reality to it. I reread the Studs Terkel book, and many of the people he talked to there had the same issues and suggested that. I left All Things Considered to write a book about a year ago, and when I came back, they said, what do you want to do? And I said, low-wage workers, and they said, fine. And I just thought it was wonderful, and I have the luxury of spending more time than we used to with people and going pretty much any place in the country to talk to people.
I should point out, I've known Noah for a long time, you bring some experience to this, and not just your work in public radio.
Well, actually, I was working in steel construction in Kentucky as a laborer when I first volunteered for a public radio station. I volunteered to do a progressive rock show from 11 o'clock at night to 2 o'clock in the morning. It was called After Midnight. This is back in the early 70s. And then I did a documentary for a public radio station there at the University of Kentucky. But I was a laborer at that point when I came to a full-time job in public radio. So I do have a bit of that background, and I didn't finish college. My mom, bless her heart, was a great secretary, and my dad was a great mailman in Ashland, Kentucky. Mm-hmm. So that's where we were.
You also sold used cars at one point.
So I did a lot of things.
You did a lot of things. Tell us about some of the people you met, and that's really who we want to hear about today. And I guess we're going to begin with a woman you met in Baltimore, just up the road, Laressa Matthews.
Laressa Matthews, we talked about people who are invisible. This was a complete hidden world for me. I had no idea of what people were doing for daycare. In a city like Baltimore, any city in the country, there are people who take care of children in their homes, and they don't make much money. It's pretty much the working poor taking care of the working poor. And if you'll permit, let me read a sentence, which opens the story that we did about Laressa Matthews in East Baltimore. We have come to visit Laressa Matthews at the beginning of her workday, and 10 minutes will be 5 a.m. The sky to the east is a shade lighter. Several men are out on the sidewalk a block away, drug dealers, we're told, hoping for the night's last customer. A young woman wearing leather pants and high heels walks straight down the center of 27th Street, talking on a cell phone. The two-story brick row houses are dark, but a light shines in welcome from one basement window. And this is Laressa Matthews' row house, and she takes care of 8 kids there. And she starts at 5 in the morning, and her day is over about 6 o'clock at night, and I was worn out by the time we got to the end of that. And I asked her, near the end of the day, why she did it, why she worked so hard.
Let's listen to that cut of tape.
I like to see the way Daisy is and Abigail. When they were little, you could just about tell their personality or what kind of person they're going to be. This is my uplift. This is what keeps you going, even when you're feeling bad and stuff. So you won't just sit down and just think about the pain and how you're feeling. It just keeps you going.
That's the way she feels about it. It does provide her energy. She's in a child care community there, and her mother does it as well. Her sister does it. And she, you know, we talk about job skills, and we tend to undervalue the skill that it takes to take care of 8 kids in a situation like that. It was the most committed work performance I have ever seen in my life, from 5 o'clock in the morning till 6 o'clock at night. In the afternoon, the boys would come in and they would do their homework.
Yeah, I was impressed also that she said that she told you she'd made a lot of mistakes early in her life in terms of getting involved with drugs and various kinds of things, and wanted to make sure the kids that she took care of didn't make the same kinds of mistakes, and is also working now to try to get a degree.
She's trying to get a degree. She's trying to finish her GED, her high school equivalency. And she is an entrepreneur. She has this business. She also has, sitting outside at the curb, a 2001 Ford Expedition. And I mentioned that in the story. We got a lot of letters about that. How could she afford a car like that? One of the things she does is take people to bingo games 3 nights a week, and they pay her for the transportation to the bingo games. And she likes the truck, as she says, and is paying for it, so why not? Well, you know, what's the big deal? People, when they hear the low-wage workers talk about their situations, want to know, how can they afford a cell phone? You know, do they have a boyfriend? What's the situation there? So do they smoke? You know, I think the people in these jobs have the right to make the same kind of mistakes the rest of us make.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, TOTN at NPR.org. And let's talk to Sunny, who's with us from Wichita, Kansas.
Hi.
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good.
Good. I just wanted to call in because I just recently finished my bachelor's degree from the University of Kansas in December. And I have had the same job in the same hospital since I was 18. And I just seem to not be going anywhere. My raises don't even match the cost of inflation. And there's nowhere for me to go. And here in Wichita, Kansas, there doesn't seem to be a demand for the degree I got. I was always under the impression that if I got a bachelor's degree, that all answers would be solved and I'd make a lot of money, but it just doesn't seem to be happening.
What's the degree in?
Art history.
And what are you doing? You work in a hospital?
Mm-hmm.
Doing what?
I do surgery scheduling.
And how much do you make?
About $885.
That's not a lot of money.
No, and it's not even enough to support myself. If I had to live on my own, I couldn't, you know, pay my bills, pay my rent, buy groceries, and have a car payment. I couldn't do all those things. It would just be impossible.
So what do you see as the future?
I don't know. I always thought that education was going to be the answer, that if I went out and I sought out education, that that would be my ticket to a good job and a good living. I may have made some bad mistakes and some bad choices, but I thought, you know, at least I have a degree. I thought that this was the mecca of all things to have is mm-hmm. a degree, but it just doesn't seem to matter. People want experience in other things. It doesn't seem to matter that I have a degree.
I'm sure this is a question you've asked yourself, but, you know, looking back, obviously you're interested in the arts, but, you know, there are other more practical things.
Right. I'm about a semester away from having my psychology degree, and I thought maybe I would want to do that, but I'm too artistic. I couldn't make myself fit in that box. I had to go something arts. And I was fearful of going, like, painting or drawing or something and becoming a full-fledged artist because I thought, geez, you know, they make even less money than I already do. So I thought, you know, art history, I could work at a museum or something like that, and it just didn't seem to be happening that way.
Well, Sunny, thanks very much for the call, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Okay. And Noah, I know that some of the people you met, none of these situations are perfectly analogous, but people who've got college degrees and yet make very little money.
That's true, and you can find them doing fast food work. I was thinking there, listening to Sandy, that you could be a security guard at an art museum with an art history degree and not making very much money. You see that a lot, and you see a lot of loyalty and camaraderie in the workplace from different classes of people with different backgrounds. We mentioned earlier Marshall Cox at the KFC in Corbin, Kentucky. And he works in this fast food place alongside a woman who's been there 32 years. And she's been on the counter for 32 years. And he is taking drive-through food orders. And he's having some fun. He's 20 in his mid-20s, and he's having some fun. But he enjoys working with all of these people together from all different backgrounds.
Be just like a news radio or so, people calling in for their comments and stuff like that. It's like that, you know, but the thing is, you know, we don't talk about politics and stuff, you know, chicken. So that's about it, really, on that.
That's the man you never see, the man, the voice behind the squawk box, is the word of the fast food.
Who is that guy in that box when you drive through there? I made a mistake with Marshall Cox. I'd like to mention this because I set out to find out who these people are, but I still had problems. I wanted to take a picture of Marshall Cox at the end of his shift, and this is the place where Colonel Harlan Sanders got started in Corbin, Kentucky, and there's a big statue of him, plastic statue, and a bench, and people get their picture taken on that bench. And I asked Marshall Cox to sit there for a picture, and he got very embarrassed. His shift was over. He was still wearing a little uniform, and he got embarrassed and almost did not cooperate with the rest of my plan that day, which was to go with him to a pool room. He's a very, very good pool player. He makes money playing pool. It could be part of his future. He wants to have an associate degree as a draftsman, and he wants money to help pay for that. But I made that mistake of evaluating Marshall Cox from that uniform and not from who he is. But it worked out. We had a good day.
Let's get another caller. Jim joins us on the line from Spencer, Iowa.
Hello there.
Hi.
Yeah, I do antique restoration.
And how much do you make doing that?
My wife and I work together. We make about $20,000 a year.
And that's not a lot.
That's very little.
Why do you do it?
Well, it's, I guess, because I'm good at it, and there aren't a lot of other things I would care to do, and I like my independence. I like to be self-employed.
So, in a way, you do this by choice?
Well, I have to do antiques because I would make even less if I was doing art.
Well, I guess that's true. But, you know, if you didn't want to do this, if you needed to make more money for some reason or another, you think you could?
Well, I could go back to carpentry or something like that, but, you know, that's it doesn't give me the freedom. I'd have to be outdoors half the year. In fact, I used to do carpentry. I was making $10 an hour doing trim carpentry, and in 20 years, that's only gone up about 1%. It's pretty miserable.
Noah, you met some people not unlike Jim as well.
Right. Jim's situation sounds like it's actually pretty good because he does have a choice. He could go to something else, and he's doing what he wants to do in many respects. And in Ohio, we stopped in and talked to some actors at an outdoor drama. A lot of actors start, you know, with big hopes.
And we're going to listen to R.M. Lane, who's an actor in a production company, and let's hear what he had to say about the difference between the job he has now and the job he had before.
I was making almost double what I'm making right now. I was working at Jiffy Lube. And don't get me wrong, they treated me well as an employee. They paid me well. But my heart wasn't in what I was doing, and I was completely unhappy. It wasn't about getting up and going to work and, man, what I get to do for a living. Or, you know, seeing that one kid in the audience whose face just lights up when he sees, you know, all these Indians walk out on stage for the first time, or the first time a gun goes off, the first time horses come sweeping from every direction. It hits me somewhere in, you know, my heart that if I knew I had enough food to eat to survive, I can get to where I needed to go, you wouldn't have to pay me at all.
R.M. Lane, an actor with a Master of Fine Arts degree, speaking about the low-paying job he has. We're talking about America's low-wage workers. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255. More after a break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Thank you. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about America's lowest paid workers. NPR's Noah Adams is with us here in Studio 3A. Do you or have you ever worked for minimum wage or less? Or do you employ minimum wage workers? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now here in Studio 3A is Beth Shulman. She's the author of The Betrayal of Work, How Low-Wage Jobs Fail 30 Million Americans. And she can help us put some numbers to the names and stories that we've been listening to. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
It's a pleasure to be here.
You say there are now 30 million low-wage workers. How do you count them?
Oh, you look at basically the census and the Bureau of Labor Statistics. But I think the thing that's important is we're talking about one out of every four workers that's making less than $8.70 an hour. That's 25% of our workforce. Making less than a poverty level wage. So the people that Noah is talking about, we're not talking about a few people or kind of an anecdotal, you know, situation. We're talking about a large amount of our workforce that it's anticipated to grow to about 30% of our workforce by 2010.
$8.70 an hour. How much does that translate into per week?
It's about $18,200 a year.
Okay, whatever that. Divide by 52. Okay. Obviously, you know, that buys more in, I would suspect, Iowa than it does in New York City.
It doesn't buy a lot anywhere. You know, the thing that's kind of shocking is that we as Americans honor work, but yet we're failing to reward it to these over 30 million Americans. And these are workers in jobs that are essential to our lives. They're childcare workers, they're nursing home workers, they're janitors, they're hotel workers, they're call center workers, they're pharmacy assistants. This is the mainstream of American society and the American economy. And yet we're failing to reward it. As Sunny said, the problem also is there's no stepping stones to better jobs. It's not a situation where we're seeing people moving into the middle class. Most low-wage workers will continue to stay low-wage.
Yeah, no stepping stones is an exaggeration.
As I said, most low-wage workers continue to stay in the low-wage workforce and don't move into the middle class.
Who makes up this group? Who are America's working poor? How old are they? What sex? What color?
You know, there's a myth about the low-wage workforce. Most people have a tendency to think of them as teenagers or high school dropouts. The reality is that two-thirds are white, a majority are female. They're adults with family responsibilities just like the rest of us. They're high school educated. As Noah pointed out, many have a college degree or at least college courses. So these are workers that are basically the mainstream of a society and the mainstream of our economy.
Here's an email comment we got from Rachel in Oxford, Ohio. In response to the woman who spoke about the limited options open to her, even though she has a BA in art history, it's not enough to have the education. You must also have the drive to find what you want to do and do it. It means taking some risks.
These are workers who get up every day and every night and work enormously hard. As I interviewed workers throughout the country for my book, The Betrayal of Work, the thing that struck me over and over again is these were the Americans that were doing everything America wanted them to do. They were responsible. They were doing their jobs well. They were committed to their jobs. This was the backbone of the American workforce.
Let's get a caller involved. Julie joins us now from Searcy, Arkansas.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to let you know I had a comment about being on, I've been on both sides of that coin, both the minimum wage earner and then a salary employee.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had people that I managed, that I employed, that were low-wage workers, and one of the people that it worked for me was just the hardest working person. I had to fight tooth and nail to get her the smallest increase in pay, and it just didn't seem right, and that's one of the reasons why right now I'm a commission salesperson. But I've been on both sides of that desk, and the caller that was calling in with art history major,
yeah.
What I have to think about that is, you know, when I was doing those low-wage things, that was to get me through, you know, so that I could, you know, I had to plan. I had to think of what I wanted to do and what I wanted to be and then go for it and do everything I could to get there. And, you know, for her, she got the degree, but it doesn't have a plan.
So you think that, you know, individual drive and ambition plays an important part?
It does. If you want pocket money, or if you're a teenager, you need your experience while you're trying to do something else, that's one thing. But if it is your, if you're the sole wage earner in the family, it's the toughest thing in the world to be that low wage earner and try to bring in all the money for the family. It's just the toughest thing. I've seen it. It's so hard. It just wears people down.
Wears people down. And Beth Shulman, that's an aspect. And many of the people who are low-wage earners, single women, and some of them with children, many of them with children.
Well, again, most of them are in families. But the real issue is that for low-wage workers, it's not just that they're making a low wage. They don't have health benefits. Many don't have pension. They work the most hazardous conditions. They work the most night shifts, so it makes it difficult to take care of their children. They have the least flexibility in terms of time to take off for a sick child or to go to a PTA meeting. So these workers are not only facing a low wage, they're facing a myriad of deficits, including the fact that their employers actually give them less training than any other group of workers.
Julie, thanks very much, and we appreciate your phone call.
Thank you.
America, Beth Shulman, has always had low-wage workers. Is there something different about circumstances now? I mean, there's a lot of people who've entered the workforce at the bottom rung and worked their way up.
There was an ability to move up in America. And one of the things, as we've all aware of, is the decline of the manufacturing sector. We were a manufacturing economy at one time, and today we're a service economy. So that you see this growing sector of low-wage workforce and low-wage jobs. And one other thing I think that's important to point out, there's nothing inherent about these jobs that makes them low-wage. For instance, if you get a place where there's high union density, let's say in Las Vegas, Nevada, hotel workers make $12.50 an hour and have health benefits and a pension. The same situation, same kind of economy in Reno, a worker would make $8 an hour without benefits. So it's not the jobs themselves that somehow are low wage. It's the conditions in those jobs.
Noah, one of the places you went to talk to workers who were making little money is a place where workers, not to form a systemic contradiction, but have never made a lot of money, and that's on the backstretch of a racetrack. There were some interesting people you met there. One, a young Irish lad who had come over and hoping to become a bug boy. That's an apprentice jockey. And there were some other people you met there, as you said, trying to improve their lives.
The fellow from Ireland, we were attracted by his accent, and we just had to talk to him, and then it turned out to be a great story. I don't know how his racing career has gone this summer, but I wish him well. He was at the top of the pay scale for that particular trainer at that stable, making about $4.50 a week. A groom would make $400 a week.
And that, as I remember, works out to about $20,000 a year.
Mm-hmm. And a hot walker would make $200 a week. And the hot walkers walk the horses after they've been ridden, just walk them around and help the grooms. The thing about these jobs that astounded me is that they start very early, as a lot of low-wage workers.
Mm-hmm.
They start early. Mushroom pickers, they start early. At the horse track, they start very early. But the thing that was incredible was that they don't get any days off. They're working 7 days a week with these horses, because the horses are like babies, they say. They're like kids. You have to take care of them.
Here's a groom, Carlos Guationa, if I'm pronouncing that anywhere close to correctly, who Noah talked to on the backstretch at Keeneland.
7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
When's the last time you had a day off?
3 months ago. Sometimes I'm working for years, then in Texas I'm working for 5 years, and never had the day off.
Not even Christmas?
Nothing. No not Christmas, even. No day for nothing.
Cinco de Mayo?
Nope.
Well, you got to take care of the horses every day.
Every day.
And getting back to Beth Shulman, and as you're talking about the issues about the working poor, what are the issues at stake? One of them, obviously, the living wage. That's a campaign in a lot of places.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's choices that we're making as a society that determine how these workers can exist and whether they will have a livable wage or basic benefits. We can certainly increase the minimum wage. The minimum wage has lost $2 in value since 1968.
In real buying power.
In real buying power. I mean, so we just, at the very least, we need to bring it up to what it was in 1968. It's $5.15 an hour. That's less than $10,000 a year.
That's the federal.
That's the federal. And in fact, other states, other localities have set their own because it is so low. There's a living wage movement that's basically said, look, we need to figure out how much it really takes for people to live, and we need to set a wage that fits that, so that if you get taxpayer dollars, you get contracts from our city, you've got to pay a living wage and pay basic benefits. And a lot of communities, over 100 communities throughout the United States, have living wages.
Where does the money come from?
The money comes from the same place that it comes to pay CEOs 400 times that of rank-and-file workers. I mean, it comes out of the very basic things that an employer. An employer has a business, and obviously businesses and corporations should make fair profits. But they shouldn't make it on the backs of workers that make it totally incapable of workers to take care of themselves and their families.
More than a few businesses in this country have gone out of business in the last few years. A lot of restaurants have gone out of business since 9/11. People say now, if you're cutting into my profit margin, you're going to lose a lot of jobs.
There's been statistics and research done on what, in fact, raising the minimum wage, and they show that, in fact, there would be very little job loss raising the minimum wage. The real issue here is ensuring that if people get up and go to work, that they can make a basic wage and take care of themselves and their family. That was the promise of America. The promise of America was basic self-sufficiency, and we failed these workers.
In your research, did you find that the people who are most affected by this, the low-wage workers, are they aware of policy? Is this an issue for them?
Well, I think that the people I interviewed, I'd ask them about that, and they feel that the politicians don't respond to their issues. That's why you see that, in fact, the low-wage workforce is less likely to vote than other voters. They feel disengaged, disenfranchised. They don't have money to give to politicians, so their needs and their wants aren't being heard in America.
Is there any attempt to organize?
Yes, there is a whole variety of organizing efforts in locales throughout the country. We saw it in Los Angeles with a variety of organizing campaigns. Certainly in the mayor's race, we saw very active trying to get these issues up on the agenda.
Noah Adams, when you were talking to the people you met, were these policy issues of concern to them?
You know, I would talk to them about Iraq. I would say, has anybody asked you what you think about Iraq? And that was always an interesting way to talk to them. And I would talk to them about their tips and how they related to people. You would speak to a housekeeper at a motel. Would people leave you money on the dresser and that sort of thing? But I didn't talk very much about whether they thought they were working poor or whether they thought Washington was serving them or not. I was interested in what their situations would be like on a daily basis. And those were the really compelling stories for me.
Well, Beth Shulman, I wanted to thank you very much for coming in today.
It's my pleasure.
Beth Shulman is the author of The Betrayal of Work, How Low-Wage Jobs Fail 30 Million Americans, and she was with us here in Studio 3A. You're listening to the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Joining us now to talk about how he helped lead a successful fight against an increase in the minimum wage in New Orleans, Louisiana, is Topper Thompson. Topper Thompson is a general counsel to the Louisiana Restaurant Association. He joins us by phone from his office in New Orleans, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good morning. I'm glad to join the discussion.
Last Friday, you had a victory against the raise in the minimum wage, at least in the parish of New Orleans. Tell us about that. What were the specifics there?
Well, as counsel for a coalition of associations of small business employers, we were successful this past year in obtaining a decision from Louisiana's highest court that a patchwork of locally mandated minimum wage laws, so-called living wage laws, rather than a uniform federal minimum wage law, is not for Louisiana appropriate. The local minimum wage approach is not, in Louisiana, the right way to resolve the serious societal issue of whether wages mandated by state or local government benefits or ultimately harms the low-income workers it champions. We were successful, we believe, in overturning the locally mandated minimum wage law because of two fundamental economic principles that we believe we established. First, higher mandated wages reduce the quantity of labor sought by business. And second, the corollary is that when there are a smaller number of jobs receiving higher mandated local wages, there will be an increased competition for these jobs, displacing the very low-skilled workers the living wage seeks to protect.
As you know, I'm sure that there were accusations during this campaign that this is just people trying to hold on to their profits and pay people the least they could get away with.
Oh, there was a lot of rhetoric during the campaign. There's no question about that. But our community of employers, not unlike the advocates of higher mandated wages, is interested in improving the opportunity for less skilled workers. There's no disagreement there. We're all looking for the same goal. There are different methods that are espoused. We simply do not agree that mandated wages help. We believe they hurt the low-skilled worker. This issue engenders, no question about it, a serious debate among economists, especially among those who are most learned in the field and who have studied the issue for a lifetime. But there's one point on which all these learned economists agree, including those who argue for a living wage. The unskilled, uneducated worker is damaged by raising the minimum wage locally rather than setting the minimum wage at a federal level. Now, there'll be arguments about the extent of the damage, but there's an agreement that there's damage, and it's a twofold reason for that. Businesses on low profit margins, you were talking about restaurants,
mm-hmm.
one type business, they have to reduce their workforce, and they have to reduce their benefits to maintain their minimum profit margin in the face of the increased overhead. That's not really arguable. That's a fact. Second, and most dramatic, less qualified workers are displaced by the migration of more qualified workers from lower minimum wage jurisdictions into higher minimum wage jurisdictions. Now, here we're talking about different minimum wages in different local jurisdictions, and that is the concept of the living wage.
We just have about a minute and a half left in this segment with you, and I just wonder, I needed to ask whether you had ever held a low-wage job.
Well, before I furthered my experience and my education, I worked in many of the entry-level jobs in our economy as a laborer and fast foods as an apprentice. I was a minimum wage bartender at Tulane while I attended law school. And Tulane students don't tip their fellow students. My younger son has earned subsistent level income for several years as a very good but a very poor writer and singer-songwriter. From this experience and the two different times I was laid off as a result of rising costs and reducing revenue, I was sensitized to the truism that there is a delicate equilibrium between higher wages and demand for labor. And really, that's been the root of my understanding of economics as a base for my representation of management in the field of labor relations law.
Well, thanks very much for being with us today. We appreciate it.
And I enjoyed being with you.
Topper Thompson is general counsel of the Louisiana Restaurant Association, chairman of the labor relations group at Watkins, Latham, Winter, and Stennis, a law firm in Mississippi and Louisiana, and he spoke to us from his office in New Orleans. We're talking about America's low-wage workers, more with Noah Adams, and more of your calls after we come back from a break. Our telephone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In the headlines today here at NPR News, North Korea is threatening to formally declare its possession of nuclear weapons and begin nuclear weapons tests. The vow was one of the conflicting messages from the North at a multi-nation security talk session in Beijing. The United States is demanding that North Korea dismantle its nuclear weapons program. NPR's Mike Schuster is following the talks, and he'll have a report later on All Things Considered. Tomorrow on Talk of the Nation Science Friday, have you ever consulted a pet psychic? Do you swear you've seen a UFO? Join Ira Flato to examine why we believe in the sometimes unbelievable, plus the latest news on Mars tomorrow on Talk of the Nation. Today we're talking about low-wage workers in America. NPR's Noah Adams is with us here in Studio 3 to talk about some of the people he's met who make little money and encounter sometimes seemingly overwhelming difficulties. And I wanted to talk to you, Noah, about a woman you met in Detroit who lived in the city yet found many of the jobs that she could find weren't in the inner city anymore.
In the Motor City, she'd never had a car in her life. 50 years old, Mars Mata, M-A-R-S-Z is her name. And she had been a daycare worker for most of her career. And also, you know, you have to think about somebody who's 50 years old. What was your life like before? And she would say to me, you know, I spent a lot of time in California just traveling around with a backpack and a guitar and a couple of dollars and some apples. And I was thin back then, and I was pretty. I think she's still pretty. Mm-hmm. But I was lucky to meet Mars Mata. It came at the end of a two-week trip that we took, that I took with a producer named Ann Hawk, for Morning Edition. They said, start in Knoxville, Tennessee, and go to Detroit, go up Interstate 75. It's only a nine-hour drive. We did it in 2 weeks. I did pass up what I thought would have been a serendipitous opportunity. Along the way, we saw a broken-down circus truck. Nobody in it.
Really?
Yeah, I thought we should stop and find out what that story was, but we had to go on. We come to Detroit, and we're going into town, and Anna's making calls. We don't know what story we're going to find in Detroit. We think it's going to be a low-level production job for the automobile industry. It turns out those jobs are paying $12 or $13 an hour. We're looking for something lower than that. And we go to WDET, our affiliate there, and go into the newsroom, talk to Jerome Vaughn. Right away, he says, go downtown Detroit tonight, and you'll find the story you're looking for. It's transportation. The low-wage workers are living in downtown. They're traveling hours and hours on a bad bus system to get to the suburbs. The figure turns out to be, I didn't use it in my story because I couldn't pin it. It seems so high that it seems unbelievable. Over 30,000 workers are going out to the suburbs every day. And we found a woman named Mars Mata who had been, she's an exception here. She's had some IT training. She got laid off.
Information technology,
learned to use a computer, and got a job at a cable television company. But it had just started. She didn't have a car. She was getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning to ride buses to work and getting off at 6 o'clock in the evening, and we rode home with her on the bus. And it took 3 bus rides and 3 hours, and we got home about 9 o'clock, and that was a good trip. Some nights she could go home at 10 o'clock at night.
And she told you that, you know, it used to be easier, at least when she could listen to music.
My Walkman died about a year ago. That was my salvation.
Yeah.
And there's that wonderful picture you paint of she's coming home at 10 o'clock at night, and her cats are waiting for her in the window.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, she didn't invite us in at that time. And I think now because her house must have been a mess. There was probably no way to have time to ever clean that house. And I think about Mars Mata a lot. We played that little bit of tape about the Walkman because she and I were talking about bluegrass music, and she listens to country music and singer-songwriters, old-time music. About 30 people listeners ended up giving her a new Walkman, sending it to her, figuring out how to do that. The people who would help Mars Mata the most, though, in Detroit would be upset at that. They would say, she doesn't need a tape player. I mean, she needs that to be sure, but what we need to do is change the policy. Need to increase the bus service, improve the bus service in Detroit. After all, it had a wonderful trolley system, as many cities did. General Motors bought up the trolley system so they could sell buses, and now the buses aren't working for the people.
Let's get another caller in the conversation. Nestor joins us from Minneapolis.
Yeah, hi, Neil. Good afternoon. I am a journalist for South American television and also producing different type of shows from the United States. And actually, we just finished a piece about workers Latino workers who are working here in the United States with very little money that they get paid to work. We wanted to do this piece since a lot of people think that coming to the United States is just a wonderful idea and he will be making a lot of money. And this guy was talking about taking the bus. Actually, here in Minneapolis, I had to take the bus 10 times and 1 o'clock in the morning in order to find these people who works until midnight, and then they have to take these buses, like 1 hour long ride after working, and they have to be sleeping in the bus. And it was quite an experience for me because I also cover Hollywood story, and then, you know, covering this kind of another story, another side of how people live here in the United States. And I just wanted to mention that, too, that a lot of people who work in these situations are minorities, and especially Mexican.
Well, Noah, thanks very much for the call, Nestor. We appreciate it. Nestor points out that a lot of the people are immigrants, as are a lot of the people you met. We heard earlier from the young man on the backstretch there at the Keeneland Racecourse. Mm-hmm. And of course, you also interviewed a man who's picking mushrooms in central Pennsylvania.
18 years old. His name is Rafael Tamanes Romero. And he's been on the job about 6 weeks now. He's beginning at a mushroom plant there. 85% of the mushroom workers in southeastern Pennsylvania are Mexican. And so he has some community there. He is in a group house, sleeping in a bedroom with two other people, and actually has a pretty nice living condition compared to others that I've seen in Chester County, Pennsylvania. And in the course of a long interview, I asked Rafael, he has no car. He walks to work in the morning, and you can see them walking to work. They pick the mushrooms, by the way, at 5 o'clock in the morning because they want them to be a day fresh.
Mm-hmm.
You pick that mushroom this morning, and tomorrow morning, tonight it's sold in New York at the Hunts Point Produce Market. Tomorrow morning it's in an omelet. But I ask him if he saw the young men of Kennett Square, Pennsylvania, driving cars, going off to college, young men with money, and did he envy them in their situation?
Let's listen to that cut of tape.
I see other people that they have money and maybe they are helped by the parents, but not everybody knows how to take advantage of it. Many of these people with that money, what they use is in drugs or whatever. In the beginning, I was sad that I couldn't go to school because it was my dream to go to school. But I am forced to do what I am doing. I don't envy anyone.
Those last two statements, I am forced to do what I am doing, and I don't envy anyone.
I don't know how he's justified the latter. He is forced to do it. What he means is he's chosen to come, or he's been selected to come by his family to send money back home, as most of the people, especially the younger workers in southeastern Pennsylvania in the mushroom business. He's sending a lot of money back home.
Where do you go next, Noah, as you continue to follow this story?
I'm going to go to Maine, and I'm going to do a series about single moms who are in quite a bit of job distress, housing distress, health care distress, people for whom the emergency room, the doctor is the emergency room, and that's the next series I'm going to do. I have been tending to find stories that, as many of us do who are looking around this particular subject, you tend to gravitate toward stories that have happy endings. Somebody is going off to night school, or they are getting some training, or they have found something that works in their lives. I suspect before my time is up with this subject, I'm going to find people who are doing bad jobs at bad jobs and having a terrible time with it, because I think that's out there too.
We'll continue to listen for Noah Adams' stories as he continues his profiles of people who work for low wages in America doing different things. Noah Adams, thanks very much for being with us here today in Studio 3A.
Enjoy it.
NPR correspondent Noah Adams. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.